Life magazine once called her the most hated woman in America. Her 1963 Supreme Court case helped to end prayer in schools, and over the following three decades, she led the charge to keep church and state separate. She could be witty. She could be crude. She had the reputation for being a bully, even to her supporters. And she became something of a celebrity as a result of her campaign against religion. Then, just as she began to fade into obscurity, she vanished in 1995 in one of the strangest of America's true crimes. This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Madeline Murray O'Hare. And our guest is Anne Seaman. She's the author of a newly published biography of Madeline Murray O'Hare, which is titled America's Most Hated Woman. Continuum is the publisher. She's joining us this morning by telephone, but this weekend, on Saturday, we'll be here in Champaign-Urbana. She'll be doing an appearance and a book signing at Borders Books in Champaign Saturday afternoon beginning at 2. So if you're interested here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can head out there and meet her. And of course, if you're interested in the book, you can go to wherever you like to buy books and can seek it out. Also here this morning in this part of Focus 580, as always, we welcome questions of people who are listening. The only thing we ask of people who call in is just that they are as brief as they can be. And we ask that so that we can get in as many callers as possible and keep things moving along, but anybody's welcome to join the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Anne Seaman, is a native of Austin, Texas. Her first book was a profile of televangelist Jimmy Swaggart, which was titled Swaggart, The Unauthorized Biography of an American Evangelist. She's also won awards for different kinds of writing that she's done, writing and editing, including documentary film narrations, natural history publications, and newspaper articles. And again, as I say, she's joining us this morning by telephone. Ms. Seaman, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm good.
Well, thanks for joining us this morning. We appreciate it. The book covers a lot of territory, so I hope that we can at least give people a kind of an idea both of who Madeline Murray O'Hare was, something of her background, her place in American history, and then of the crime that in which she and one of her sons and granddaughter were murdered that put her in the news again at a point where she really had begun to fade from public view. Maybe the place to start would be to talk a little bit about her childhood and her parents. What was her family like?
Well, Madeline actually had a kind of a rough start in life because her mother tried many times to abort her and found it necessary to tell Madeline this all the years that she was growing up. And I'm not really sure why her mother, Lena, had to do that, but she, you know, she ate a whole jar of mustard and she threw herself down the stairs and so on. But Madeline was apparently destined to be here because she survived. And the mother was a little bit superstitious. She read tarot cards and tea leaves, but she also sent her kids to church and made them say their prayers at night, just sort of covering all the bases. Madeline had a difficult relationship with her entire family. She was constantly quarreling with them, and I guess they were all four quarreling together. She had a brother who was about 2 years older. But she was always the smartest of all of her cousins, and in her crowd, she was always the smartest kid. And she grew up to be a very intellectually restless person. She joined the Army and became a second lieutenant, and while she was in the Army, met a man named William Murray and had his child. He was a married Catholic and wouldn't leave, he couldn't divorce his wife. So I think that's kind of where Madeline's antipathy for religion may have started, with her inability to make a permanent bond with this man. She named her son Bill Murray, William the third after his father, even though she didn't carry his name, but she took the Murray name later when Bill was about 5 years old, and it was Bill on whose behalf she filed this lawsuit. In her younger life, when Bill was a little boy, she got a law degree in Houston, Texas, and she moved to Baltimore with her parents and her brother, and they all lived in a row house, and during that the ensuing years in the late 50s, I'm sorry, and by 1960 she had become kind of a communist ideologue and actually tried to defect to the Soviet Union. And that defection attempt was kind of what sparked her lawsuit, because she was told that she would be of more use back home. So that's kind of her beginnings.
Where along the line do you think the important influences were that maybe shaped her political, ideological mindset?
That's a really good question. Madeline had always, from when I talked to her high school friends in Ohio, where she went to high school, she had always felt like an outsider. And she felt this way from a very young age, partly because she had a physical condition called a pectus excavatum. It's a sort of like a depression in your chest, in the right at the top of your chest. And she had a little misaligned ribs, a little bit of maybe scoliosis. And she was very ashamed of her body. And she was smarter than everybody else and felt an outsider. So that was kind of just in her, you know, in her milieu that she grew up in. Where her anger and determination to change America came from outside the home was, I think, probably when she was in high school in Ohio, she became acquainted with someone who ran a drugstore, and he was sort of an ideologue, and there were lots of exciting political discussions in his drugstore, and that was where she kind of felt she had a place there, where she didn't even in her own family feel like she belonged, but she felt good about that. I think it was I can't remember the name of the drugstore. It's in my book, but I think that's where her political idealism was sparked.
She had two sons, both of them with men that she was not married to. She, as you mentioned, she went into the military. She was in the Women's Army Corps. She was a WAC. She was posted to Europe, and when she met this man, Joseph Murray, she had a son, William, by him. Then later when she came home, she had a relationship with another man and had another boy, John Garth.
Right.
And so she had these two sons.
Right.
What was her relationship? And of course, there's a long and tangled story about her relationship with them, particularly with her son, William, who later became a born-again Christian and became the complete opposite of what his mother was.
That's right.
But what was her relationship like with her two boys? What kind of a mom was she?
Well, Bill, on whose behalf she filed the lawsuit, and he worked for her till he was in his 30s, in American Atheist, helping her movement. He wrote a kind of a Mommy Dearest book when he was in his early 30s after he became a Christian. And in that book, he described her as a neglectful mother, but loving. But her love was kind of fierce and cannibalistic. She just poured her heart and soul into these kids, and they sort of became her trophies, or they were supposed to, like Bill remembers getting toys that were too complicated for him when he was little, because she very much needed him to be smart. And then when Garth was born, both of them born out of wedlock, and this was in the 40s and 50s, Bill 1946 and Garth in 1954, and this just wasn't done, having a child. I mean, it's done all the time now, but it just wasn't done. And so she had quite a bit of anxiety about that. Even though she was defiant about it, she had a lot of anxiety, and so she sort of needed for her kids to succeed greatly to overcome some of that. Her mother did most of the early child rearing of the boys, because they all lived together in the same house and Madeline worked.
Later in life, after she had the falling out with William, then her second son, and they were very close together in age, John Garth, really became the person that she relied on, and it seemed that he perhaps saw himself as her caretaker in a way, was her main support. And then, interestingly enough, then this kind of family unit formed involving Madeline, John Garth, and a granddaughter who was the daughter of her first son, William, who was married very young, and then that marriage came apart, and it seemed that neither of the two parents either wanted to or could care for this girl, and so she ends up becoming becoming the child of the grandmother.
Right.
And so then the three of them not only were a professional kind of association, because they were all very much involved in this organization she founded, American Atheists, but they constituted a kind of a family.
That's right. I mean, I can't believe you got that whole complicated mess out in such a short time. It was really a Byzantine story. Bill got a girl pregnant when Bill was 18 and the girl was 17. And they had this little daughter, Robin, and Madeline ended up adopting her because she was just pretty much neither parent. They were both teenagers, and neither one of them was really interested in settling down and raising a little girl. And Madeline had always wanted a daughter, and she just adored Robin. And really, Robin was a wonderful kid. But in the same way Madeline had sort of fiercely loved her two sons, she visited that on her granddaughter, and so Robin was raised with just heaps and heaps of love and affection and approval. And yet, if she ever tried to break out on her own or do something her grandmother didn't approve of, there were these sometimes subtle and sometimes not subtle ways that her grandmother just twisted her back and, you know, made her come back into the family circle. Bill got very tired of that, And there were a series of just horrendous fights and horrible scenes between Bill and Madeline, and he finally broke away from Madeline. And the only way he could do it was by just becoming the opposite of what she was, Christian, you know.
So. Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Ann Seaman, she's the author of a biography of Madeline Murray O'Hare. It's titled America's Most Hated Woman, and it's published by Continuum. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, she will be here in Champaign-Urbana for a talk and a book signing at Borders in Champaign on Saturday, beginning at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So if you're interested in meeting her, you can head out there. And, of course, anywhere that you are interested in buying your books or that you go to buy your books, you should be able to find a copy of her book if you'd like to read it. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller, and we'll bring them into the conversation here. Someone listening in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi. My main question is, why do you think that the Murray O'Hare case became the symbol for atheism and separation of church and state issues, when right here in Champaign we had the McCollum case, what, a good 5 years earlier?
Yeah, well, it was the McCollum case was actually, I think, decided in 1948.
And good 13 years earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Madeline's was 1963. And, in fact, there was a lot of communication between the McCollum family and Madeline. But I think, Mrs. McCollum she wanted to solve a problem, and that was that her son was being put out in the hallway during the school mandated, I think it was half an hour every Friday or something,
right,
of church instruction at his public school. And she tried to work it out with the school district, but couldn't. And she said, this is just not right. Children should not be going to church on Fridays in school. Send them to church. You know, they have churches for this. And it was a very clear-cut, violation of the separation of church and state, at least in my mind. But Ms. McCollum just wanted to solve a problem. Madeline really wanted to build an empire, and the reason that she got so much notoriety is because she actively went out seeking it. She really was savvy about how to use the media and how to sensationalize things. She was called the most hated woman in America, partly because of some of the things that she said publicly, like, you know, God is sadistic and brutal and a representation of hatred and vengeance, and she said that she'd turn every church into a hospital or sanitarium because leave it to God and it won't get done. Things that offended devout Christians. You know, she said that the Lord's Prayer was something muttered by worms groveling for an existence and so on.
She struck me as someone who was just like a little kid who was holding her breath in order to get attention.
Madeline never held her breath, though.
Well, that's true. Okay, then yelled at the top of her lungs.
She yelled at the top of her lungs. You know, it's easy to dismiss Madeline as attention-seeking, and a lot of people did that over the years. Finally, after years and years of her, really a lot of stunts that she pulled to get media attention, she was kind of dismissed, and reports, you know, she was sort of became a semi-tabloid figure in Austin when she finally ended up in Austin. But at the same time, it just can't be underestimated how much attention she did bring to these issues. And her other big legacy was that in the 50s and 60s when she was doing this, there was this big communist scare in the beginning of the Cold War, and communists and atheists were considered synonymous. And, you know, the general public didn't seem to be able to allow anybody to just be unchurched or atheistic without hating them. And so there was a lot of persecution, and Madeline's
that's true.
Brassiness undercut all of that. You know, she also formed a huge international network of free thinkers and you know, church-state separation, secular humanists, and like-minded thinkers. So that's her place in history. She was courageous. She weathered all kinds of death threats her entire life, and she was she was a beacon for a lot of people who were persecuted by religion.
Yeah, but don't you also think that she was she did just about as much harm for those of us who just don't happen to believe, and then we get tarred with her?
You know what? That is the question that my book raises, because when I first started on this book, I thought that Madeline's case with Bill Murray, you know, getting reading the Lord's Prayer, this was mandated by the Maryland Public Schools, I believe by the state, certainly by Baltimore. And she heard this, and it seemed pretty clear-cut to me that, yeah, you don't have to, that shouldn't be mandated in school. You know, the school said it was a good way to start the day. It put people in the right frame of mind, and that may be true. Maybe in a moment of silence or something, it is good for the beginning of the day. But after a while, some of the suits that she started to file, she called them educational suits or attention-getting, you know, and partly because, you know, she sort of made them outrageous, or people felt they were. She filed to get the Under God taken out of the Pledge of Allegiance and In God We Trust off of our money. And she, you know, she in Austin filed a suit first, and she lost that, or she filed it in the wrong jurisdiction or something, but it's to get these big stone tablets of the Ten Commandments off of the Capitol grounds in Austin. And that's in the Supreme Court right now. They're going to announce that this month. So she had some, like, very big attention-getting lawsuits, and that was how she sort of kept in the public eye. And then these smaller lawsuits, like churches can't play bingo, you know, churches can't be polling places, you can't have free parking on Sunday, you know, baccalaureate services. You know, she sued, or she was involved in a suit with North Carolina, which its state roadmaps contained a little prayer for safe travel. She, you know, there were many. She tried to get a little cross out of the city seal of Austin. Things like that were just seemed so trivial that when you start,
we are awash in symbols. There's no question of that.
Yeah, well, you know, the debate comes up as to how much of a Christian nation are we, and where do these things become so intertwined as you drill farther and farther down? How do they become so intertwined that you you really can't separate them without just destroying the harmony of the fabric of the culture?
Yeah, forgive me for jumping in there. I just wanted to say thanks to the caller and say we're getting very close to our midpoint here, and I think we're getting somebody else set up. And if others would like to call, you're certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Again, we're talking this morning with Anne Roe Seaman. She's the author of America's Most Hated Woman, The Life and Gruesome Death of Madeline Murray O'Hare. It's published by Continuum. I'm sure that some people would argue that in leading social movements for social change, you have to have someone to pick up the metaphor of, that you and the caller used. You have to have someone who's willing to yell.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, though, I'm sure that within those social movements, there are people who look at these kinds of leaders and just sort of shake their heads and think, I wish we could have someone a little bit more prudent. Someone who is probably a little bit more of a diplomat, somebody who was, little, you know, could be a little, could get our message across and yet somehow be more subtle. Now, maybe that doesn't work. Maybe you have to have the, you know, maybe you need agitators. I guess I would say, yes, we definitely need agitators. But I guess what I'm thinking of is within this vast movement of people who are concerned about the issue of separation of church and state, how did people feel about the fact that she was perhaps the most prominent, she was the person who was out front, she was the person who was in the spotlight?
How did her own group feel?
Yes.
It was extremely dichotomous. Just, you know, just like most things in Madeline's life, there were two very dramatic sides. And one camp said, she is a complete hero to me. I was so persecuted, and, you know, you can tell this by some of the hate mail that Madeline got, that there was a persecution problem for people who were, I guess they were considered godless communists. You know, one guy was run out of his small town. When he revealed that he was an atheist, he had his head shaved and was run out of town. Somebody else's business was boycotted. Somebody else got their phone disconnected by the phone company. People were persecuted and hurt by religion. Some people had personal stories to tell about, you know, being, you know, just being hurt by. And there's news stories too about children being allowed to die. I guess they're, religious sects that refuse medical care for their kids, and so there was a problem. And then on the other hand, there were the people that said Madeline is not respectable. She's profane. She would write these letters. And just put them in the mail with all kinds of filthy language in them. She got mad at her followers. She wrote one guy who had worked real hard for her come down and volunteered from Ohio. She wrote him a letter, just scalding letter, saying, your pants were too tight, your fingernails were dirty, you were a disgrace. And he had just spent a week working his head off to help her, you know. So, there's no, you know, you can't really land on one side or the other when you read this book. You just shake your head because there were so many things to admire and so needs that she filled, and yet she sort of ran it into the ground and broke it off. And people were saying, my gosh, you know, she won't get her hair fixed, she won't lose weight, she's not very presentable, and yet, you know, she was a beacon to people. So go figure.
Let's talk with someone else. So we have another caller here. Again, I believe in Champagne. This is line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hi.
I just have a couple comments. One, when you're talking about, you know, her yelling, and you got to have people in some movements yelling and things like this, I used to think that we should do things in a subtle way always. But then I came across this a gay rights organization called the 85% Coalition, and their whole goal this is a couple of years ago, was to seem kind of radical, to stand outside right-wing legislator's office and you know, seem radical and loud. And that way, the organizations who are fighting for social change in our state that were already established would seem more moderate.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point.
And it's actually worked in Illinois. Just a year, Illinois finally passed equality law. And so you can't discriminate against gay people in Illinois anymore.
Mm-hmm. That's a good analogy.
Then also just like to make a comment, as an atheist, I find her as almost a hero. Mm-hmm. Just, I know she was very abrasive and at times very rude, and I wish she wasn't that, but as a educator in the Champaign School District, I am inundated daily with God. Mm-hmm. It seems to be passively accepted to mention God at assemblies, to just for instance at our graduation the other day, God was mentioned 7 or 8 times. That seems to be okay all the time, even though our school is very diverse, Buddhist, Muslim, you know, everything in our school. Mm-hmm. So although I think we've come a long way towards separating church and state, it seems to be still okay to...
It just makes you wonder if it can really be separated, if it's so important to people to be able to say God. And, you know, school is not just secular. When people go to school, they bring with them their backgrounds. And
exactly.
It seems like a question, to me, it seems like a question of how to find a balance. I'm just Madeline's biographer. It's not up to me to really how to find a balance. Madeline didn't want a balance, really. She wanted it eradicated, and she actually said many times she wanted religion eradicated.
I'm with you. I don't want religion eradicated. I understand it's very important to a lot of people, but I do get frustrated on a daily basis because, you know, in my school, for instance, I'll meet people and they'll like me and things like that, and we'll start chit-chatting, and all of a sudden they'll come up.
Mm-hmm.
And when I tell them, well, yeah, I'm atheist, they're like, no, you're not. I like you.
Would you feel more comfortable?
I get cynical and say, yeah, that's very Christian of you not to like me now. But
that's a good answer. But I'm just wondering, would you be more comfortable if the word God wasn't mentioned at all in school? Or if it was forbidden?
No, I don't want it forbidden. I just don't think you should be on an official program, because religion is a huge part of our country's history, and it will always be part of our country. But when we have a situation where we have kids, like I said before, we have such a religiously diverse population. When you just mention God, well, then what are these, you know, Buddhist kids thinking? And what are these Hindu kids thinking? You know, they're like the other group that really aren't counted just because they only make up 3% of the group.
Well, you know, you're saying God. I don't know if there's so much objection to the concept of God as there is to different kinds of gods.
God. They mentioned Jesus Christ a lot.
Yeah, and that's what I found when I did my research, that Jewish kids were sort of... you know, made very uncomfortable by all this talk about Jesus, you know.
Right. We had an assembly last year, and an individual who was very important to our school and very popular in our school, we're going through the assembly, and I'm kind of emceeing, and he said, oh, can I say just one thing? And I thought, oh, great, he's going to say something great about the program. Blah, blah. And he got up there and went on a 5-minute rant on how each child needed to know their personal savior, and and this was on live radio all over town. And
that's unbalanced.
I just want to say thank you for writing the book. I'm going to go out and get it.
Good.
I want to read about it.
Thank you.
But, I was very happy that she came along. I'm glad this topic is still being talked about.
Yeah, I don't think people realize how much it's sort of metastasized into confusion about people really are confused about whether. I mean, I was listening to a radio talk show one day, and the caller said, "Is it okay if I say?" He was going to say Merry Christmas or something on the air, and he said, "You know, because these are public airwaves," and so it's sort of like, you know, my First Amendment rights to say, you know, Merry Christmas over the air are gone because the public owns these airwaves. It's just mass confusion. People really don't know whether it's okay to, you know, to say have a moment of silence in their school. You know, they really don't know.
Hmm. I want to thank the caller. We got some other folks here. We're now coming into our last half of the show, and our guest is Ann Seaman. She's the author of a biography of America's, that's the title of the book, America's Most Hated Woman. It is a biography of Madeline Murray O'Hare, and it's published by Continuum, and she will be here in Champaign-Urbana this weekend. She'll be doing a book signing and talk at Borders in Champaign Saturday afternoon starting at 2. So if you're interested in meeting her, you can stop by there, and of course, if you want to read the book, you can go to wherever it is you like to buy books. Just before we get some other calls, I do want to have you talk at least a little bit about the other big part of this story, and that is the what happened to Madeline, her son, and granddaughter.
Yeah.
And this takes us back to 1995, and this was at a time when, it seems to me at least, they had been out of the national spotlight for a while. And in fact, I seem to recall reading some of those first stories about their disappearance and thinking to myself, gosh, I haven't heard that name Madeleine Murray O'Hare for years and years.
Yeah.
And what happened was, in it was the summer of 1995, the three of them vanished, along with a significant amount of money. And there were a lot of stories floating around. There was speculation about the fact that they had embezzled this money from their organization, that they had left the country, and that they had gone to, you know, you fill in the blank about where it is you think that they had gone.
Yeah.
And of course, what happened was, ultimately happened was, they had been kidnapped, they had been held for ransom, and they had been murdered.
Yeah, and by the three of them, that's Madeleine and her younger son, John Garth,
and her,
Bill had long fled the family, and Robin.
The granddaughter.
The granddaughter, right. John Garth was 40, Robin was 30, and Madeleine was 76. And they had been planning to flee. They had been setting up a secret flight to New Zealand, and they had been funneling millions of dollars over into New Zealand in order to do that. It was secret; nobody knew about it, but a couple of insiders, and they were fleeing because they were afraid they were about to lose two big lawsuits, and one of them had to do with the IRS suing them for unpaid taxes and the other one had to do with their lawsuit against the Truth Seeker Corporation. That's a complicated story, but really it's got a lot of Madeleine's emotional life and kind of surfaced in those two lawsuits that she was fighting. They had a long history with her, Madeleine's hatred for the IRS and her she kept watching the Truth Seeker Foundation the corporation become richer and richer and richer, and she felt like she should be part of that and was justified in some ways. But those were what she was fleeing. And in 1993, she hired a David Waters to be her office manager, a very well-spoken, intelligent, educated guy, nice-looking guy, charming, with a genius IQ, and at least two murders under his belt at the time he went to work for her. And she didn't know about the murders, but David was so devious. It was unbelievable how cunning he was. He started as a typesetter, and he, you know, worked his way into Madeleine's trust and became the manager and was able to have access to all kinds of information that other people didn't know about. And he knew she was squirreling money away in New Zealand. It didn't take very long for David to get crosswise of Madeleine and quit. And at the time he quit, he stole $54,000 from her. And she had filed a suit against him. And he was the one that kidnapped her, John and Robin. And the strange thing was that he held them for a month in San Antonio in a residential motel. And there was sort of a Stockholm syndrome took over, and David had two guys helping him guard the O'Hares while they repatriated this New Zealand money back to the United States. And David had it converted into gold coins. $500,000 worth of gold coins had come in, and there was still $100,000 to go when things took a very bad turn in San Antonio, and it necessitated the killing of all three of the O'Hares. So that's in a nutshell what happened. But basically, that kidnapping, once they were kidnapped and left, nobody really looked for them very much. The Austin police did a very sloppy job, and they weren't that interested in everybody. In fact, thought it was because they wouldn't look for the O'Hares because the O'Hares were atheists. And that I don't think that was true. I think it was just they had a brand new detective on the case who had never done a homicide. But that true crime thing, how basically a reporter in San Antonio unraveled this mystery and handed the FBI two-thirds of their case. And the family was missing for 5 years, and they finally... David Waters had gotten backed into a corner and finally revealed where they were buried.
The authorities apparently always suspected him of being the mastermind. Now, he has since died. He died in prison in 2003. He had cancer. But you had the opportunity to meet with him and talk with him in jail on a few occasions. What did he say about his role in this?
David... always presented himself as a victim, and he did it very with a lot of confidence and assertiveness. You know, he basically presented himself as the victim. But once, and that's just the posture that a lot of guys have in prison. There, nobody ever really did anything wrong that's in prison. And but he let me know that he had sort of an admiration for Madeline. Everybody really admired her intellect and her courage. And people like David admired her sassy, bold profanity and stuff too. But what he essentially told me was that she was a mark waiting to be had, and he probably would have robbed her in some way even if she hadn't made him angry. What she did that really set him off was after he stole this $54,000 from her, she published she had a newsletter and a magazine. And in her newsletter, she found out a whole lot of real bad dirt on him, including the fact that he had beaten his mother and urinated on his mother. And she published that in her newsletter and sent it out to all her members. And someone sent him a copy, and he was absolutely furious at having his cover blown and at having, you know, these humiliating things about him so widely known. But even if he hadn't been that angry, he would have robbed her sooner or later because he just saw vulnerability there, and that was what he was like.
Yeah. After he led the authorities to the place where the bodies were buried, I guess eventually Madeline's older son, William, got the authorities must have felt that he would be the most appropriate person to take responsibility for the remains of his brother and his mother, his brother and his daughter, and had them buried at an undisclosed location.
Yeah.
What sort of service was conducted? That seemed to me to be perhaps one of the ironies that there would have been any words at all spoken over this woman who was so famous for being an atheist.
That's right. There was a big contention over the remains. Once they were dug up from the shallow grave in South Texas, the American Atheists organization that Madeline had founded and is still thriving in New Jersey now, they asked for the remains of all three of the Ahares because they hadn't spoken to Bill for 20 years, and you know they considered Bill a traitor, and Madeline definitely had. You know, disowned him and said she didn't want him to have anything to do with any burial, and she certainly didn't want any prayers said over her. And but the FBI, who had possession of the remains, and they had to be identified by a forensic anthropologist, and that took about a month, and then the FBI had to decide, and they decided in favor of Bill just because the Texas law says that remains go to the next of kin. So. But Bill wanted it to be a secret, their decent burial that he gave them in a proper cemetery. And there were really only a handful of people there, about six people. And I was one of those. And there were FBI patrolling the perimeter to make sure that no one from American Atheists had found out where this place was. And the kind of service that was conducted, Bill said to everybody there, he said, you know, my mother didn't want to be prayed over, and I'm not going to pray over any of my relatives. But he said, I can't stand to have more of a circus act around my mother and brother and daughter. Their life had become a circus, and I just want it to end right here. And he said, all I want to say is that I just hope this is the end of this curse for our bloodline. And that was it. And then he is an ordained minister, Bill, and he gathered the small group of us over in another part of the cemetery and prayed for healing and for the police work that still remained to be done to hold everyone responsible who had participated in all of this.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have some callers. I get back to them right now. And again, maybe I just mention once again that our guest is Ann Seaman. She is the author of this book about Madeline Murray O'Hare. It's titled America's Most Hated Woman. Continuum is the publisher. Let's go next to talk with someone in DeWitt County. Line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Morning.
I think it's Well, it goes along with the uncovering of Deep Throat recently, who said, follow the money. And it's like everything about her life, at least her later life, came down to that. The same way it has in a couple of civil rights leaders who just missed the opportunity to show their faces and collect more money.
Well, that was definitely the case with Madeline, but it was also for John McCormick, the San Antonio reporter, who was he was nominated for a Pulitzer for his work on the O'Hare case. I think he filed about more than 80 stories on Madeline. And he followed the cell phone calls, because that's really what the O'Hares had a cell phone in San Antonio, and you know, he tracked down David Waters came onto his radar screen very early on, but the cell phone and the money, those were definitely the things he followed, for sure.
Yeah. Had this man, you say he committed two murders, was he convicted of those, or just...
One of them he committed when he was 17, and he and some buddies beat a 16-year-old boy to death in Peoria, where he's from. And the second murder occurred in 1984, and the police in Peoria thought he did it. But David was actually, he was paroled from that first murder. He only served 12 years, even though he drew 30 to 60. He only served 12. And then in 1984, about 38 years old, he killed a guy named Billy King, but they couldn't pin anything on him. But they were pretty sure it was David. He had a really long rap sheet. And there was another person who was last seen in David's company around that same time, who was never heard from again. And then David's wife was mysteriously murdered in 1980. So he has a lot of stuff. He had a lot of stuff behind him, and more to come in 1995.
One other question, a little arcane, but did Madeline ever go after the Freemasonry symbols that are so prominent?
Yeah, yeah, she did, and she went after anybody who I've forgotten the way that she went after the Masons, but there, I have a list here of some of her lawsuits from the 70s, and they're pretty. It's pretty comprehensive. And the Masons are in that list for something they were doing wrong. I can't remember exactly what it was.
Our nation wasn't founded as a Christian nation. It was founded by Freemasons.
Well, you know, there were the Mayflower Compact was sworn, you know, in the presence of God, and in the colonial period, there were rules that stated that all of our rights came from God, that public servants had to believe in the Bible. People could be fined for working on Sunday, stuff like that. So there was a heavy hand of religion that helped form the ideals of this country.
And the cornerstone of the Capitol building was laid by George Washington in a Freemason ceremony.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Well, thank
right,
you.
Well, let's go to another caller here next, Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Hi. Well, thank you for a very interesting program. And I had one comment and sort of a question. Did you know that Mrs. McCollum is still living?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And
yeah.
She's living in this town and actually doing very well. And I just called her and said that her court case was favorably mentioned on your...
Yeah. She had a... her case was just really way above the fray. I mean, she did this. It was a big sacrifice for her. It was a very courageous thing that she did. And then when the problem was solved, she went back to her life.
Right.
Madeline made this whole thing her life, and she built a multi-million-dollar empire on it. So.
Yeah. Well, Mrs. McCollum suffered quite a lot too.
I know.
I had a couple of other comments. Earlier this morning on NPR, they had an interesting piece about the Air Force Academy graduation. Did you happen to...
No, I didn't hear that. What happened?
Well, there was some controversy because there's been quite a lot of fundamentalist Christian activity, and they actually had an investigation, and they're having these classes for religious tolerance. It was a very interesting piece. You might want to.
This is it's the line between religious tolerance and tolerating the violation of the Constitution is very, very fine. And there are some areas where you really just have to throw up your hands. You really, and the scales have tipped down in the nitty gritty where people live. When these decisions are made, you come up with things like the third grader who said, "God bless America" or something at lunch, and was put on probation. Things like that. Just things that it seems to be sort of a waste of our time to deal with, but. But that's how confused people are.
All right, let's talk with someone else here. Bloomington, Indiana, line number two. Hello.
About Hi. That confusion, it is confusing, and it's absolutely made this doctrine, this legal doctrine of separation of church and state, has caused a lot of confusion. You might be interested in the fact that the Chief Justice of our Supreme Court, William Rehnquist, agrees that it has caused a lot of mm-hmm. a lot of confusion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't conclude anything else when you... When you ask yourself, should we sandblast the carving of Solomon off the Supreme Court building, or what?
Right. Justice Rehnquist made a historical study of the history of the wall of separation.
Uh-huh.
He found there was no historical basis for it.
Well, the language doesn't come from the Constitution. It comes from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to some people in Danbury, Connecticut.
Yeah, which means just exactly the opposite of how the court has construed it. And of course, it also has no legal bearing. It was a letter,
It was a letter, and I think it was under the Warren Court that phrase was picked up and sort of began to become sort of a substitute for the words of the Constitution. That term has been used very liberally.
Jefferson was quoted. Earlier, before he was quoted as a evidence for separation of church and state, he was quoted earlier in the 1800s in Reynolds versus the United States
mm-hmm.
to demonstrate that just the opposite, that the only way that religion would enter into law would be actions rather than through beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
What somebody said, but the point that Justice Rehnquist found no historical basis for separation of church and state, he complained about it in one of the legal cases. He wrote about it that it was a dissent, mm-hmm. but in the case of Wallace versus Jaffe, Justice Rehnquist, he's kind of expressing his frustration, and, mm-hmm. and here's what he says. This is a quotation from his dissent. He says, "There is simply no historical foundation for the proposition that the framers intended to build the wall of separation, mm-hmm. and no amount of repetition of historical errors in judicial opinions can make those errors true." He says,
well,
"The wall
yeah.
of separation between church and state is a metaphor mm-hmm. based on bad history, a metaphor which has proved useless as a guide for judging." You see this frustration there? It's
yeah,
a bit confusing,
yeah.
And it should be frankly and explicitly abandoned. He says.
Well, a lot of people interpret the First Amendment to not even prohibit establishing religion in each individual state. Each state can establish a religion if it wants to. The First Amendment only forbids a national religious establishment.
The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law.
Yeah.
So very well. However, the 14th Amendment, when the 14th Amendment was adopted after the Civil War.
Right, the 14th Amendment has been used to globalize a lot of ideas.
Yeah, but the religious guarantees were not originally devolved upon the states. Just citizenship,
mm-hmm.
and to abolish slavery. It had nothing to do with religion.
Yeah, I think the 14th Amendment has really been expanded to include a lot of things, and actually the result is sometimes, or at least some people feel this, that the sovereignty of the states is undermined by the 14th Amendment.
I'm going to jump in here because we're pretty much out of time. I'm sure this debate will continue because it certainly seems that we're debating these issues just as intensely now as
yes.
we were when these Supreme Court cases that we have discussed were new. And I don't expect that it's probably going to be resolved ever, do you think?
No, I don't think there's going to be a, an ultimate resolution. I just think that it'll be like any other paradigm that has reached its maturity and has started to create more problems than it solves, and then it's time for a new paradigm. And I think that that's what's happened to the wall of separation.
Hmm. Well, just going back to for a moment here to finish up our conversation about this one individual that we talked about, Madeline Murray O'Hare. What do you think is her her overall legacy as far as America is concerned?
Well, her legacy is partly just the confusion that we talked about, but her legacy is also she's eradicated this, her activities and her prominence eradicated this stigma on people for not, for being unchurched and for, you know, just having their beliefs. That was one, and she often said that her major triumph that she felt was her first one was removing the stigma for being a communist and being a traitor to your country. But she also, she fought for, she felt like she was fighting for people's rights and freedom and raising their awareness, and she felt like she was giving unbelievers a safe harbor, and she started a major network of like-minded thinkers all over the world, and she left a big body of writings, and she started a library that preserved tons and tons of free thought materials that are priceless and part of our history.
Well, there we will have to leave it because we're here at the end of the time. Again, for people who would like to read more on this story, you can look for the book. It's titled America's Most Hated Woman, The Life and Gruesome Death of Madeline Murray O'Hare by our guest Anne Roe Siemens, published by Continuum. She will be here in Champaign-Urbana this coming weekend. She'll be doing a signing and a talk at Borders in Champaign on Saturday beginning at 2 in the afternoon. So if you're interested, you can stop by there. Otherwise, if you'd like to look at the book, you go down to wherever it is you'd like to buy your books. And Ms. Seaman, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.